Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Conference podcast. I'm Lisa Pruitt, a center faculty affiliate and the organizer of our November 2014 Poverty in Place Conference. This conference brought together scholars from across the social sciences to present and discuss new work on how space and place inflect various dimensions of poverty. In this presentation, Kai Shaft discusses his work on the creation of inequality in Pennsylvania's shale gas boomtowns. Shaft is an associate professor of education in the College of Education at Pennsylvania State University. He also directs the Penn State Center on Rural Education and Communities.
I have a lot of thanks to give out first. First of all, I really appreciate being invited to this this workshop. This is just great, and it's been really interesting and really enjoyable. And I'm really excited to present this work. This is absolutely hot off the press. I sent my paper late to Jonathan because I literally couldn't write it because I was in the field doing the work. And so a lot of the stuff that I'm going to be talking about is based on conversations and data gathering that happened as a week ago or less. Although I've been doing work in this area for the last couple of years, I'd also like to acknowledge contributors to this work. This is part of a much larger project that I've been working on with colleagues from the Department of Rural Sociology at Penn State. And it's been funded through the Center for Rural Pennsylvania with institutional support from Penn State. So that's all been very important in this work. Jen Sherman has been someone who, has been an important sounding board for a lot of this work, and some of her research on constructions of morality and work have directly sort of influenced my thinking around these issues. So what I'd like to do is, first of all, give an overview of the talk. I'm going to provide some background on unconventional shale gas development, or as it's more commonly known, fracking, and the Pennsylvania context. I assume that most people in this room have some background or have some knowledge about what this is. So I'm going to run through that fairly quickly, but I think it is important just to set this work up. I'm going to talk then about the framing, the discursive framing of Marcellus shale development in terms of both risk and opportunity, and this framing that takes place as sort of in public discourse, but also the way we can rethink that framing in ways to better understand the production and reproduction of poverty and inequality in the midst of boomtown development. And so that's what I'm going to end up with is some presentation of data on what I've been doing, looking at poverty creation amidst this shale gas boom in Pennsylvania. All right. So first of all, unconventional gas production and fracking. It refers to gas reserves that are they're held within. Unconventional reserves, which means that instead of being trapped by a geology, and what you do is you drill down into that geology, and there's your deposit. It's sort of contained throughout a geology, like a shale layer. So in a way, you can kind of think about the analogy that helps me to think about this is: imagine you took a can of Coke and you shook it up, and then you flash froze it. So you have all those little bubbles that are contained throughout that frozen Coca-Cola, and that's sort of the same situation with unconventional gas deposits. And so in Pennsylvania we have what's called the Marcellus Shale, and the Marcellus Shale is a shale layer that is between 20 and 200 feet thick, and it is between 1 and 2 miles beneath the surface. And so in the last 10 years or so, a combination of existing technologies were developed and refined in order to access the gas within these shale plays, and the technologies combine horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. So what happens is that you have this surface of the land up here, and then the shale layer down here, about a mile, mile and a half down, and the drillers drill the well bore down and then drill it out horizontally along the shale layer. And then ultimately they pump between 2 and 10 million gallons of water, including small proppants, usually pieces of sand or ceramic, and lubricants and biocides and other chemicals down into the shale layer, where it fractures the shale and releases the gas, and the gas flows back up through the well. So although these technologies, both horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, have been around for decades, in order to extract gas from reserves like the Marcellus Shale, they really have been developed. And the result of this is that the industrial scale of extraction activity has really expanded exponentially. Drill pads are several acres in size. Each well uses 8 to 10 million gallons of water, of which as much of a third returns to the surface and has to be disposed of in one way or another. And of course, it returns to the surface not only with the chemicals that were put into it to pump it down into the well, but also with brines and heavy metals and naturally occurring radioactive material that's in the shale layer. So this represents some pretty tricky issues as far as both the pumping of the water and then the disposal of the water. In total, a well pad like this can require as many as 5,000 or 6,000 heavy equipment trips. So, you're really talking about huge impacts on local roads, damages to local roads, lots of significant questions about environmental impacts. It's raised a lot of questions and concerns about ground and surface water contamination, the fragmentation and disruption of landscapes, concerns about the effects of roads and infrastructure, and of course, it's not just the well pads, but the building of the pipelines as well. So anyway, I've been working on these issues since about 2010 with several distinct research efforts. The first one was a survey that was administered to educational administrators across Pennsylvania's Marcellus region, and I kind of argued that educators and educational administrators were particularly good community observers of community change, because unlike certain people placed within communities like business owners, landlords, landowners, this kind of thing, they didn't have a particular dog in the fight. And they also worked with a broad segment of the community because of the students and the parents that they worked with. So they were in a good position to see the kinds of changes that were happening within the community that other people may not have had a chance to see. So that was combined with a set of focus groups and key informant interviews conducted with educators and key community stakeholders across the northern tier region, sort of the northern part of Pennsylvania, where a lot of this gas development had been taking place. And then most recently, an extended 4-county case study of multiple community impacts of Marcellus development in both north central and southwest Pennsylvania. And this includes analyses of secondary data, focus groups, interviews, additional field work. And this has been ongoing since 2012. So this is a 3-phase, 6-year project, and we're sort of in the middle of the second phase right now. And this has looked at everything from health impacts to educational impacts, housing, what else? A whole number of different things. But the piece that I've been really focused on in the last year or so has been the experiences of low-income individuals and low-income households. And so that's what ultimately I'm going to move towards in this talk. So this is a map of Pennsylvania showing the geologic extent of Marcellus Shale formation, and the counties where we've done most of our work, and Bradford and Lycoming in the northern tier. This is the northern two counties in this extended case study, and then Washington and Greene. And the data focus specifically on low-income households will come from mostly from those counties. Okay, so a number of publications have come out of this so far, including work that's been published in the Peabody Journal of Education, Society of Natural Resources, Rural Sociology, a forthcoming piece in Human Organization, as well as a number of reports and extension briefs. So we've really been quite productive with this work. Drilling has taken place mostly in Pennsylvania, although you can see the shale layer extends into Ohio and down into West Virginia and up into New York. Drilling has taken place in Ohio and West Virginia as well, although New York has a drilling moratorium in place pending an extensive ongoing environmental review, and so it's not clear exactly what's going to happen with New York. But I guess the point is that this is not simply an issue for Pennsylvania. And in fact, there are gas reserves across the United States that are experiencing unconventional extraction activity, and indeed globally. So this is really taking place all across the world. And in fact, I was in Spain last July and came across this graffiti here. So what's going on here with Marcellus Shale? You know, it's been really interesting to me as a sociologist being based in Pennsylvania. When I got to Penn State about 10 years ago, no one knew anything about Marcellus Shale or fracking or any of this kind of stuff. One of my colleagues at Cornell, I think, puts it really aptly, that few natural resource features have moved from obscurity to center stage in so dramatic a fashion and within such a short time frame. And so in 2003, the estimated recoverable amount of gas from the Marcellus Shale layer was about 1.93 trillion cubic feet. And by 2009, that estimate had jumped to 489 trillion cubic feet, or the equivalent of 20 years of domestic natural gas demand. So the way that I think about this is having a bank account and thinking that you have $1.93 in your bank account, it's not even worth going to the bank to take it out because it's going to hardly buy you a cup of coffee, and then waking up one morning realizing, wow, I don't have $1.93. Actually, I have almost $500. So it's that sort of jump. But the fact of the matter is, these estimates are just that, and they're based on incomplete information and changing technology, and the estimates have jumped up and down quite a bit. A more recent estimate from the USGS is 84 trillion cubic feet, which still is an enormous amount of gas. The Marcellus Shale play is agreed to be the largest natural gas reserve within the U.S. and one of the largest in the world. All right, so it's all often called a game changer for Pennsylvania, and I think that most people agree that it has been a game changer for better or for worse. And it's been particularly a game changer for rural and non-metropolitan areas. And a lot of these areas are areas that have, for a long time, experienced economic stagnation, net out-migration, aging populations. In fact, I remember interviewing a school district superintendent probably in 2005 in Bradford County, which really is sort of the epicenter of a lot of this drilling activity. And in 2005, he said to me quite bluntly, you know, my job is to provide our students with the skills and the knowledge that they need to get out of here because, frankly, there's no opportunity for them here. And so that's sort of a context for a lot of these areas in which this drilling has taken place. And you can see this here. A comparison of the 50 wealthiest school districts versus the 50 poorest school districts and the school districts with Marcellus wells and the total number of wells. I mean, this is really concentrated mostly in rural areas and mostly in very poor areas. Okay, so another issue here is the rapid pace, scale, and unpredictability of development. And, as I said, not even 10 years ago, this was just not on people's radar screen at all. And now it's really fundamentally changed the landscape. So this is a map that shows the development of the shale play over time. And you can really see the ways in which it's developed unevenly. So you have these concentrations up here in the northern tier and then down in the southwest. And then some drilling taking place in between with some localized areas of concentration. And most of that has to do with the sweet spots of where the most of the gas is within the shale play. Okay, so by November 2014, nearly 9,000 wells have been drilled in Pennsylvania, and with projections of as many as 60,000 or more wells to be drilled in the coming decades. That said, well development has dropped off, and this is partially a consequence of this technology and the extraction of natural gas and the impacts on global gas markets. I mean, basically, the gas market's getting glutted with gas, driving the price down, which in turn depresses the drilling activity. So if we want to think about this in terms of boom bust, I wouldn't call this a bust yet, but it's certainly, but if especially if you go up into the northern tier of Pennsylvania, people will tell you that the activity has really slowed down. So a very contentious issue with significant debate over environmental impacts, community impacts, economic impacts. And the framing of Marcellus development in the popular discourse has tended to take one of two positions. It's either a massive opportunity, an enormous economic windfall, or a massive risk. And the graffiti there says, that hydrofrack won't taste so good in your beer, milk, and soup. So from the opportunity side, of course, you have the gas industry, state government, some academics, and Penn State actually has been sort of typecast as an institution that has been, on the whole, more friendly towards the gas industry. This is from an industry group, Range Resources, or I guess I think this is, Range Resources. Natural gas drilling by Range Resources is making a real difference in the lives of people throughout Pennsylvania. That's true. We know them. We know because we met them, talked with them, heard their stories firsthand about how their lives are changing for the better thanks to Range Resources. And a lot of the development was really pushed ahead by Tom Corbett, who in fact just made Pennsylvania history by being the first governor not to be reelected. And in part that happened because of his massive cuts to education, although there is also a lot of question about his stance on taxing the gas industry, and he was adamantly opposed to that. He had some great campaign advertisements, and I was going to show you one of them, but they all got pulled like 2 days ago. But there's this other piece from the Marcellus Shale Coalition that I think gives you a sense of this kind of discourse around shale gas. So I'll play you this for about 2 minutes.
Fundamentally changes the playing field in terms of the energy balance, both in the region and in the nation. We now have a natural gas surplus for the foreseeable future. That's enough for Pennsylvania to be warm in the winter for the next 212 years.
Pulling gas from the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania is estimated to produce more than 212,000 jobs by 2020.
Currently, Cabot, through use of direct employees and contractors, has created more than 250 full-time jobs.
A Penn State study predicts the industry will employ more than 110,000 people by 2011.
The unemployment rate is high. We know people are looking for jobs, but we do anticipate overall there'll be thousands of new jobs created directly and indirectly. The duration of the jobs could be, from one decade to five decades.
We would like to see our young people have a place to stay in our area and have jobs.
Companies say their industry will have a ripple effect, an idea that is coined the Marcellus Multiplier.
Every dollar that a Marcellus Shale producer invests, it spins out an additional $1.90.
Money that could provide momentum.
You have whole communities essentially that won the lottery because of these lease payments. But this is a huge mineral resource that's coming to market at a time the market is asking for more and more gas.
There's a lot of things.
Okay, so you get the sense of this. All right, and one of the studies that was cited in this was work by Engel, actually Considine, that predicted these huge amounts of jobs. And that report was later debunked when it was found that it was funded by the Marcellus Shale Coalition. And one of my colleagues, Tim Kelsey, has done a lot of work looking at job creation and has. He's come up with much lower job creation numbers, and this is kind of a nice cartoon of him, you know, with a pin puncturing the Marcellus economic impact claims. Okay, so you have this framing of this incredible economic opportunity, or you have this framing of it as a massive risk, and most of this comes from the blogosphere, environmental organizations and activists, some academics. Here's a guy offering you a refreshing benzene spritzer from his well. But what about the creation of poverty amidst the boom? And I guess you know the link to Jen's work comes back from my initial experiences hearing people say to me again and again and again, anyone who wants a job around here can get a job. And therefore, the people that didn't have jobs obviously didn't want them. But it was clear to me that you know this wasn't the economic miracle that the Marcellus Shale Coalition was presenting. So, in the midst of this framing of Pennsylvania shale gas development as alternately an economic miracle or an environmental catastrophe, I think what's really overlooked are the multiple risks and opportunities. So this is not just massive opportunity or massive risk. It's both. And these opportunities are multiple, and the risks are multiple, and they're unevenly distributed. Okay, so if we can change the conversation to acknowledging these multiple risks and multiple opportunities and how they're distributed, maybe we're in a better position to understand what's taking place and to possibly to manage it. So these risks and opportunities are unevenly distributed, not only across individuals and households, but also across space and over time. And it's this uneven distribution of risks and opportunities that can create new and exacerbate existing economic insecurity, even in the midst of boomtown development. So, you know, I'm not a natural resource sociologist, and so I'm vaguely new to this, but it seems to me pretty clear that there are several distinct, though complementary, lines of boomtown research. One is social disorganization studies, which sort of came out of work beginning in the 1970s, which were largely descriptive studies focusing on the conflicts between old-timers and newcomers, stresses on community institutions, increased crime, this kind of thing, but not really any kind of focus on poverty creation. And then there were social psychological studies, which sort of built off of the social disorganization studies, and most of these had to do with people's perceptions of community attachment, anomie, that kind of thing, a sense of personal safety and well-being. And then finally, a major strand of boomtown research has, you know, with a nod to Willie Nelson, I call the phases and stages, the social and economic effects across the stages of the boom-bust recovery process. And this is, this is a real concern. This is a graph of workforce demand based on Wyoming data, but it applies equally well to the Marcellus gas fields, and it shows the demand for work across the development phase, which is, you know, the building of the well pads and the building of the pipelines and the drilling, the production where basically the gas is flowing and you're monitoring pipelines, and then reclamation. And you can really see this huge drop off. And so that's what people are talking about when they talk about the bust. People in Pennsylvania communities know about this, and they're concerned about this. A survey respondent from, you know, the Survey of Educational Leaders said, "What happens after the shale is depleted of natural gas? Does the industry leave us high and dry like the coal barons did?" Another person said, "I feel this can be the greatest discovery if handled with thought and care, and the biggest disaster if squandered." Now, this is a really interesting quote, I think, because it gets back to this issue of of risks and opportunities and how to manage risks and opportunities. And shale gas development and fracking in general, if you look at the public discourse, it seems like a very polarizing issue. You're either really for it or you're really against it, and there's no middle ground. But in fact, with this work that we did, the survey work, we asked a number of questions assessing perception of risk and a number of questions assessing perception of opportunity. And we also used GIS to map out the concentrations of drilling activity. And what we found among these school district administrators was that the perception of risk was directly correlated to the perception of opportunity. The more risk you perceive, the more opportunity you perceive, and vice versa. And that, in turn, was directly correlated to the concentration of drilling activity. So what does this uneven distribution of risk and opportunity look like at the individual and the household level? How do we think about this? And how do we think about it in terms of the relationship to the creation of new poverty, displacement, and social exclusion? And so I've been turning this over in my mind, and it seems to me we can think about this along several different dimensions. One is kind of cross-sectionally, in terms of the kinds of characteristics that may alternately expose people to opportunity or vulnerability or risk. And clearly, in the gas fields in Pennsylvania, the people who stand to be most exposed to opportunity, cross-sectionally, are landholders, especially those with large plots, homeowners, landlords, young adults, healthy adults, male adults, skilled with qualifications, and here mostly I'm talking about things like welding, commercial driver's licenses, this kind of thing. Also, people who have strong family networks. The people who are most at risk include landless, renters, people who are middle-aged or older, disabled, people on fixed income, people who are unskilled with no qualifications, female. I should add in here also single-parent households, and people who are socially isolated with weak kinship and friendship networks. So you can think about this sort of cross-sectionally, but you can also think, okay, well, here. So here's a great quote. And this is a guy who I talked with last week. And the quote is interesting because he really talks about this bifurcation of opportunity and risk. Come on now.
I'd say it has created a lot of work, and then it created a lot of misery too, I think.
Is that
because,
right?
Because there's people out here looking for houses every day, and you're looking to pay for a two-bedroom house, $1,200 a month. Come on, who can afford $1,200 a month on an income of maybe $2,000 a month? Mm-hmm. I mean, that'd take your whole check and every time you pay your bills and everything else. There goes your whole paycheck.
Right.
I mean, it just, and then I wonder why people come to the food banks and well, what are we supposed to do? I get like $150 in food stamps. You think that lasts me a whole month? I don't think so. I don't see it. They're just ruining the economy in my book.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, they might be benefiting from it.
Yeah.
But we're not. Who's benefiting? We're not going to benefit from it. The only thing we're benefiting from is going poor or being poor or one of the two. I mean, the rich might be richer and the poor get poorer.
So that was a 56-year-old man, disabled, who's, as he noted, is really sort of scraping by. And this next quote is really interesting as well, because this person, who is a female resident of Bradford County, 52 years old, single, she actually worked for the industry for a short amount of time. And I was asking her about the gendered aspects of opportunity, and she talks about that as well as a number of other things too, including the social isolation and a few other things. It's interesting how gendered the industry is. I mean, you hear about man camps, roustabouts, roughnecks, landmen who come out and sign the leasing agreements to get them signed. And on the other hand, and a lot of the pictures that you see of people working in the industry are people like this guy here, this guy with a hard hat. But on the other hand, you have this attracted to the gas industry called Rig Maids. And I don't know if you can see it, but it has a ponytailed woman in a short dress with a feather duster dusting off the drilling rig.
As far as fracking goes, as far as like oil wells goes, it's very much a man's world. Because, like I said, my friend said to me, oh, come here, Treehab's right down the corner. They're hiring for oil. You know, it's not just Chesapeake, it's Chief, it's this, it's that. I'm trying to think of the other. There's been a bunch, you know, and then, of course, now the lease issues and all this other stuff. But somebody like myself, who doesn't have a clan or a family that's lived here for years without, you know, that land, I don't have that extra money rolling in. So it makes it really kind of hard to live around here.
Yeah.
I think if you're 18 years old and you've just graduated from high school, or you're a young 21-year-old and you're a male, you can get a job like that. Mm-hmm. I think if you're a female and you're very female and attractive to the guys, especially the bosses, you could get a job like that maybe in the office. But usually you want people with no experience. Or they take people that are older, but I would say older meaning in their 30s, you know, that might have experience having, you know, or might have gotten a CDL or something like that.
Right.
Now, I can't get a CDL. And when I asked, you know, when I inquired at Mountain Energy, can I get out of this position and maybe move into a driver position or something? No, we don't do that.
Okay. So one thing to keep in mind as well is that when the industry came in, most of the jobs ended up going to people who came in from out of state, who had background, had experience doing unconventional gas drilling. And so there's a real sense among many people in these communities that, oh, well, we got sold this bill of goods that this is going to be all this job creation. In fact, there was a lot of job creation, but it didn't go to us. It went to these other guys. Another way of thinking, a second dimension of thinking about this, is how exposure to risk and opportunity may change over time. And we can think about this, you know, for sure in terms of the boom-bust cycle, right? And that graph that I showed you, what happens when you know, you hit that downhill slope. So in other words, what's the longevity of opportunity here? But also in terms of things like fluctuations in global energy markets, the unpredictable cost and availability of housing, and this is a particular issue here, and I'm going to talk more about that. The regulatory stance by state and federal governance. So for the last 4 years under Corbett's administration, it's been pretty much of a free-for-all. Under the new governor, we'll see what happens with that. Also, at the individual level, injury, burnout, or locality of work. I talked to a man last week who was injured on the job site. He pulled a hose out of a well, and the fluid from the hose splashed over his head and into his face, and even though he was wearing a hard hat and goggles, it got down into the goggles and swelled his face all up, and he had to go to the hospital, and he was in the hospital for a couple days, and when he got out of the hospital, he found that he was no longer employed, and I asked him if he was able to collect workers' comp, and he said no, he didn't know how to do that, and if that was possible. Okay. This was a particularly interesting quote, and you know, one of the dynamics here taking place in these counties, especially in the Southwest, is that Pennsylvania, of course, has already experienced a number of booms and busts in the past with lumber and with coal, and this person here talks about sort of the time dimension of vulnerability and opportunity.
So I think people in our position have had an advantage from having an outside looking in mm-hmm. perspective. For a lot of people, it's way of life. But coming here, I hear all these, well, back when the steel industry was this, and back when the whatever industry was this, and this and that. And in the particular area that we're in, Washington County, they've suffered these booms of industry. They got, there's this great great opportunity for people to get these jobs, high-paying jobs. Maybe it'll lapse into the next generation so they can bring their children on board into the that booming industry, and then it flops or it moves on, becomes outsourced somewhere else, or however you choose to look at it. But either way, what goes up must come down. And so you have generations of people that have lived in this area, that lived here during a huge economic boom and then a downfall. Economic boom and then a downfall. Mm-hmm. And in that downfall, depression raises high, crime rates raise high, everything just seems to regress. And so when I see an industry like this, personally, and come into this particular area, we'll just see history repeating itself.
This is a guy who is employed full-time and has some college education and has been homeless for a year because of the housing markets. A third dimension to understanding risk and opportunity and how it can vary is over space. And that spatial dimension interacts with time as well. And of course, just by looking at this map, you can see the unevenness of development and by extension, the variability in impacts. So the impacts here, right, are going to be very different than here. Of course, that's going to change as the development proceeds. From a spatial perspective, we can think about things like the density of infrastructure, including housing stock. Areas with larger housing markets are better able to absorb this new demand. Health services, industry, the sites of extraction versus the sites of industrial staging. So in the northern tier, a lot of that area is quite rural. But then you have Williamsport, which is a small metropolitan area that's been used as a site of staging and activity for the industry. Fluctuations in global gas markets, and this is sort of interesting. I showed you the picture of the drop-off of gas production, right, early in the presentation. Well, here's a comparison of Bradford, Lycoming, and Greene in Washington County. And Bradford and Lycoming are right here, going up like that. So you can see that there's a very steep spike in production and then a very steep drop-off as well. This is the northern part, while in the southwest, Greene and Washington County, has been a pretty steady rise. And one of the things that happened here was that in the north counties, the gas was mostly methane. So they call it dry gas, whereas down here there's lots of propane and butane, wet gas, and the markets for methane were flooded, and the price had dropped. But that was not so much the case for propane and butane. These different areas see some very different patterns in terms of development. Long-term environmental and health consequences of unconventional gas extraction, unpredictable cost and availability of housing. These are all going to vary over space and over time. So housing markets and displacement. I want to spend some particular time talking about the issue of housing. There were two dynamics at play. One was an influx of workers from out of state, mostly from Texas, Oklahoma, places like that. And this led to a radically increased demand for housing, often in places that didn't have a whole lot of housing stock to begin with. So there was a very, very intense pressure on housing. And then secondly, these people coming in, oh boy, okay. I'll try to wrap up, had salaries that far exceeded what had existed previously. And so there was a demand plus an ability to pay top dollar plus a precedent of others growing rich off the gas industry, notably leaseholders, shaleyonnaires, and the landlords wanted to get in on this. I began to hear stories about Hummer homeless, that is gas worker families living in temporary circumstances, and the families would drive their kids to school in the Humvees. As a point of fact, most of these workers came in without families, but you would hear things like the Hummer homeless. Section 8 was unable to use vouchers because the fair market rent is retrospectively calculated and it did not reflect price spikes in any kind of way. So housing authority workers found a radically increased demand in vouchers and vouchers that they were at risk of losing because they couldn't be used. Okay. So I'm gonna play you this one. This is particularly interesting quote, and this is about the housing.
So you know that 2008 to 2010.
Wow.
Okay, I'm in this house, and he starts seeing this money coming in to the area, and he's thinking now he needs to boot me out because he's only getting $400. That's all I can afford. So he says, I'd like to have more income in here to pay the expenses, pay the taxes, you know. So then, therefore, I say, okay, I'll look for another place. I'm in college, working as much as I can work with the children. So then, I'm out there looking for rent. All of a sudden, the gas starts coming into this area, early 2011, it's starting to really boom in this area. People are saying rent is between $800 and $900. How can you afford this being a single parent with three children? Technically three, because she was at college, but she would come home. I just couldn't do it. So then, everywhere you look, this is what it was, March. He calls up and says, since you won't get out, I'm going to sell the place. I have a buyer from the pipeline company, Atlas, I think it was at the time, who wants to buy my house, and he wants to pay. And this thing was only valued at $68,000. So you can't say that it was very much of a house, but I mean, it was my home. And he says, the guy wants to give me $189,000 cash to put his guys up into this house.
Wow.
Okay. So now you just knocked a family out onto the streets. I had nowhere to go. I was homeless. There was no place to go. No house. I mean, I couldn't afford those houses out there. And what you could afford was like cockroach infested places. I mean, it was low living. I don't want my children there. So I have always, just to put this into perspective, had my children either homeschooled or private school, paid for private school, because I didn't want my children involved in what was in the area.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had a protection around them. So now I'm homeless and nowhere to go.
Okay, so I'm going to wrap up here. In Pennsylvania, advocates of shale gas development within the region have emphasized this windfall economic benefits of industrial development. In the meantime, they've simultaneously tended to frame local, social, and environmental risks as mere factors in a broader marketplace of costs and benefits. Opponents of shale gas development have alternately emphasized unacceptable environmental risks and uncertainties. But this discursive bifurcation, however, misses the complexity of how these opportunities and risks are unevenly distributed across people, places, and over time. And given the ways that boomtown development can paradoxically create new poverty, insecurity, and inequality, the situated specific economic circumstances of many residents in Pennsylvania's shale gas region reflect the broader ongoing conflicts between the well-being of rural communities and neoliberal logics that view rural and economically marginal places as a periphery whose role is to provide human and material resources to an increasingly urbanized core. So I'd like to suggest a number of implications. First, the Boomtown scholarship and its focus on the boom-bust cycle and the creation of economic insecurity in the bust has largely missed the ways in which uneven structures of opportunity and uneven exposures to risk create new poverty and insecurity as a consequence of rapid economic expansion and development. So more attention needs to be paid to the uneven consequences of boomtown development across all stages of the boom-bust cycle, and particularly the ways in which existing inequality and insecurity can be dramatically exacerbated in the midst of economic boom, where anyone who wants to find a job can find one. Second, the boomtown literature rarely considers how differing spatial and institutional contexts may affect the ability of individuals and communities to adapt, adjust, and respond. So what are the consequences for those at the economic margins in these different places? So attention to the spatiality of boomtown development enables us to think about boomtown development and its impacts in a cross-sectional rather than a longitudinal way. Right? So in other words, the variation in development intensity, and you can think back to that map of Pennsylvania, and the impacts at one time over space as opposed to the variation over time with regards to the boom-bust cycle. How are these peripheral areas affected? So for example, do displaced residents priced out of rental housing find themselves moving to adjacent counties? And if so, what are the impacts there? So Pennsylvania, under the leadership of two governors, has aggressively pushed shale gas development. Under Tom Corbett's administration, in particular, state policies have been heavily pro-industry, under the neoliberal assumption that the development of the Marcellus Shale will create critical economic growth, and particularly in areas of the state that have long lagged behind in job creation. So there's no question that economic development has occurred, but what has been largely overlooked are the ways in which many of Pennsylvania's most vulnerable residents have not only been largely excluded from the creation of new economic opportunities, but how they have also been most immediately exposed to new insecurities that are largely invisible amidst both the discursive framing of unconventional gas development as either an economic godsend or an environmental catastrophe, and boomtown scholarship that likewise overlooks processes of exclusion, displacement, and impoverishment. So thank you so much, and Jonathan, I'm really looking forward to hearing your comments.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.